and digital characters to protect yourself. You don't use anything shorter than 8 to 10 characters.
So we can't use 1111111.
And that's a very popular, the most popular password today.
Which for the world, that's what I always do.
Hello, everyone. It's the Two Boomer Babes.
Millions of Americans are having their identities stolen. What you can do to avoid becoming the next victim.
Coming up, the real story of women in today's military.
What's described as sumptuous, seductive, and even celestial?
Chocolate, of course. You'll get the skinny on the amazing man behind one of America's favorite chocolates.
And we babes are hitting the road in style, shopping around for the perfect RV. In 2003, the Federal Trade Commission began tracking the number of identity theft victims. Last year, according to Javelin Strategy and Research, nearly 13 million Americans had their identity stolen. That's a million more victims than in 2011. And the reality is, one in five Americans will be touched by identity theft in 2013.
Our fast-paced digital world has given rise to new scams and a whole new dialect. Words such as phishing, farming, vishing, spoofing, sniffing, skimming, squatting, and spimming.
As a victim of identity theft, Dale Penn learned the hard way. Now he knows what precautions you can take to avoid becoming the next victim. Dale is the author of Identity Theft Secrets, Exposing the Tricks of the Trade. He joins us from Los Angeles. Glad to have you with us, Dale.
Glad to be with you, babes.
Dale, what is identity theft, and is it something new?
Well, identity theft technically is defined by the Federal Trade Commission as when someone appropriates your personal information, like your social security number or your credit card account number or your checking account, in order to commit fraud or theft. So it's the stealing of your personal, non-public information for the intent purpose of committing fraud or theft. We've been seeing a trend since 2009 where the identity theft numbers have been slipping down, but beginning in 2009, they crept back up, and again, 2012, this past year, we had a million more incidents leading to over $40 billion of identity fraud and identity theft.
Wow. Okay, so how does the thief get our information?
Well, a lot of us tend to think that identity theft only happens in the cyber world. The reality is that identity theft happens in the real world, too. It's the mail that comes into your home. It's the mail that goes out. It's the mail that goes in the trash. It's the mail that you post. It's your personal private information, your social security number, your name, your address, your credit card numbers, your date of birth. Many of those things are things that we've grown accustomed to sharing on social media sites like Facebook and Pinterest and so on. The third tool that people don't realize can be appropriated or stolen by the bad guys is your payment tool, whether it's a credit card or a check or even a debit card. And then finally, most of us know that computers and other versions of computers, smartphones, et cetera, and all mobile devices, those are also very, very vulnerable, but there are a lot of things your listeners can do to protect themselves.
My husband was one of those statistics. His identity was stolen a few years ago, and he thought it was because of his social security number. If you had to pick one of those things, would it be social security numbers that would be the most easily to steal?
In the world of identity thieves, the social security number is the coin of the realm, if you will.
The big kahuna.
That's the big kahuna. That's what they're after. And unfortunately, our social security numbers are something that we need in order to get medical services, very often to get employment. Protecting your social security number should become a habit, a conscious habit, but it's also something that you can track to make sure that it's not being used inappropriately or incorrectly or in an unauthorized way. And I'd like to share some of those ways you can protect yourself.
Who are these thieves that steal our numbers and wreak havoc on our identities?
Unfortunately, according to the Fair Isaac Corporation, which came up with the FICO score, their research shows that the majority of ID thieves, unfortunately, are people that we know, people that we trust, people that we do business with. The reality is that friends and family who have access and people who have access to your home, they have the best access. As a matter of fact, they know all your personal information. They know the name of your dog. They know your address. They know where you live. They know some of your secrets. So people that we know and trust are very often responsible, and unfortunately, that's something that we're all vulnerable to. The reality is that identity thieves all over the world are very, very good at slipping away, and that's why identity theft is the fastest growing crime in the world and simultaneously the most under-prosecuted crime in the world, and that's because of the anonymity of the internet.
Let's talk specifics. You were talking about tracking your credit score, and you suggest that we should scan our credit report 3 times a year. How do you even do that?
You go to a federally mandated, federally monitored site. It's the only one in that sea of offers that we all hear about on television and in the radio. There's really only one destination that I send my clients to and my readers to and your listeners to, and that is annualcreditreport.com. Again, federally mandated by the United States government, federally monitored. It is the compilation of the three big credit aggregators. That's Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. You can receive one of those credit reports from each of those credit bureaus once per year.
Is it free?
It is absolutely free, and it is instantaneous. Let me just tell you, when I ran mine, I got a 30-page report, printed it out right there on the spot. It showed me every detail of every credit transaction I've had over the last 15 years or so. And that's the best way to know what's going on without having to pay someone to give you that service. Again, it's annualcreditreport.com.
Do you need a course in order to figure out how to read the report, or is it pretty self-explanatory?
Yeah, really?
Yeah, you don't have to be a cyber geek to understand it, because I'm not a cyber geek. All you do is go to the website. It'll ask you for some personal information. It's safe to put it in there. If you go to the Federal Trade Commission's website, FTC.gov, what you'll find is that they even recommend that that's the place that you go. Now, the beauty of this site is that if you stagger your requests, that is, you ask for one, let's say, in February, you ask for another one in June, you ask for another one in October, you can literally get year-round monitoring without having to pay for it by staggering those requests.
Great tip. We're talking with Dale Penn, an identity theft expert. Are some people more vulnerable than others to having their identity stolen?
Yes. Unfortunately, the statistics are out. And those of us that are involved in social media have a much higher incidence of identity theft. Those of us who use mobile devices, that's smartphones and iPads, etc., those are, unfortunately, they're gateways into private information for the bad guys. So those of us that are active in social media and using our smartphones are a little bit more vulnerable. A lot of folks think that the elderly are more vulnerable than others. The reality is the old bank robber, Willie Sutton, was asked once why he robbed banks. And, of course, his answer was because that's where the money is. Often the elderly are targeted not because they're more vulnerable or they're senile. They're targeted because that's where the money is. So it's very easy to target folks with these new phishing scams, especially this time of year, because we're talking in tax season right now, and the tax fishers, the tax scammers are out. So I want everyone to be aware that if you receive an email from anyone offering you help with your taxes, it is a scam. Delete it and ignore it.
Do you recommend just stop using our smartphones for purchases, for example?
Absolutely not. The beauty is that these smartphones can be updated daily if necessary. And if you practice good data hygiene, the same data hygiene that you practice with your computer at home, good antivirus protection, good password protection. And by the way, good password protection means that the password is long, you don't share it, you don't leave it out, you don't leave it laying around, you make it mysterious, and that you use at least 8 to 10 characters, numeric and digital characters, to protect yourself. You don't use anything shorter than 8 to 10 characters.
So we can't use 1111111?
And that's a very popular, the most popular password today.
Which for the world,
password.
That's what I always do.
Where are we supposed to store all of these passwords?
Yeah,
I can hardly remember, a combination to my bicycle lock.
I do have my passwords written down. They're not written down on a piece of paper that anyone that comes into the house can find, but I do have them written down. For those of you that want to digitize, you can digitize with companies like KeePass. KeePass has a digital device that allows you to create random and very effective impenetrable passwords and store them automatically, and then you change them regularly. So I would urge everyone to give very strong consideration to using 8 to 10 character passwords, and very much like underwear, make sure that they're long enough, you don't share them, you don't leave them out, you change them often, and that they're very mysterious.
And they're clean. I'd remember much better if they're not clean. Absolutely. Let me ask you, Dale, does freezing your credit report help stop identity theft?
Absolutely. It is probably one of the most effective tools that they've come up with. Freezing your credit report, which you're allowed to do with all three credit bureaus as often as you want, also gives you the option of unthawing when you need to unthaw. Now, let me just remind your listeners that if you freeze your credit report, which you do by contacting any of those credit aggregators, and that information is available at my website, information for the three credit aggregators, and you can probably put it up on your site for listeners' convenience. If you ask them to freeze your credit report, you will not be able to get credit going forward. It is frozen solid like a block of ice. The good news is that bad guys cannot create new accounts that way. But the problem is, and I do have some solutions, I don't want to just scare your listeners, it doesn't protect you from the other forms of identity theft. Freezing does not protect you from medical identity theft. It doesn't protect you from criminal identity theft. It doesn't protect you if a company you do business with, like TJ Maxx or DSW Warehouse, gets breached. It doesn't protect you that way, but it does protect your personal credit profile and anyone from opening up new accounts.
My goodness, so many things to think about. Let me ask you about the junk mail, which we all get tons of.
Yes.
What, besides being a nuisance, is there a way to just opt out of this? Because that's another way for identity theft to be, for our identity to be stolen, right?
That's a terrific question. Again, if your listeners will just call 1-888-OPT-OUT, 888-OPT-OUT. Again, it is a site that is monitored to make sure that it's not abused. And opt-out will get rid of about 60 to 70% of the junk mail that comes your way. And I did it, and it works. It takes 2 or 3 weeks before you begin to see a decrease in the flow of garbage into your inbox, into your mailbox, but it really works. Again, that's 888-567-8688. That is how you opt out of all of that junk mail. And as you know, junk mail offers, especially credit card offers, can be taken from the mail if you're not smart enough to shred every piece of mail that you've put in the garbage, and can be used to open new accounts in your name.
Right. Well, what happens to the other 30 to 40% that doesn't get opted out?
The 30 to 40% that doesn't get opted out is generally from people who you do business with, who they will not remove. If you're already doing business with, say, Bank of America or a catalog company, they can tell the difference between the people that are authorized and the ones that are not authorized to send you offers in the mail. But it will decrease your mail 50, 60% almost instantly, within a month.
Dale, just want to ask you a real quick question about shredding. You mentioned shredding. So
yes.
Everything should, we should shred it all? I mean, we could spend all day and night doing that. Good grief.
I do live in California, and on trash night, at about 3 a.m. in the morning before the trash cans are picked up, we can hear people going up and down the streets, going through garbage cans. Now, if they get a can or a bottle and it blesses them, I'm happy for them. But if they get my unshredded personal information out of that mail, out of that trash can, shame on me. So I would urge you to simply remember that anything that has your name, your address, your Social Security number, an account number, your phone number, or your date of birth should be shredded before it's placed into the garbage pile.
I think we need to invest in a large shredder, Kathy.
A really big one, or a shredding company. Identity theft expert Dale Penn, author of Identity Theft Secrets, thanks so much for sharing some terrific tips. Boy, we babes have a lot of work to do.
Great to talk to you, and the great news is it's easier than you think. You can find my book, and you can get the tips, or you can visit my website at dalepenn.com.
Thanks, Dale. Up next, women on the front lines in combat. Stay with us.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
The pen.
Pentagon made history by lifting the ban on women serving in frontline combat. Proponents cheered the decision with a rousing, "It's about time," while critics said our military strength will be harmed, perhaps fatally.
Weighing in on this issue is a daughter, sister, and wife of Army colonels, Tanya Bianc. She's the author of Army Wives, on which the hit television series is based. She's also traveled the world with the troops as a newspaper reporter. From these experiences, she's written Undaunted, the real story of America's servicewomen in today's military. Talk about timely.
Tanya joins us on the phone from Virginia. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Kathy and Barb.
Well, with the lifting of the ban, what are female soldiers now allowed to do that they couldn't have done before?
Well, what they will be able to do is they will be able to be full members of the combat arms branches, which includes the infantry, the armor, the field artillery. Right now, there's no such thing as an infantry woman, for example, just an infantry man. So these frontline jobs, where they have not been able to serve, they can now try out for.
Now, what about the special ops like the Navy SEALs or the Rangers? Can they join that?
As of right now, yes. But in mid-May, the service branches are going to have to go back to the Department of Defense and make an argument of why certain branches like the Special Forces or your SEALs should remain closed. They would have to make that argument of why women should not be allowed to be in those units. So they have until about May 15th to show the Department of Defense how they're going to implement these changes, and then January 1st, 2016, they will have to execute these plans.
Well, with the lifting of the ban, is this going to open up more opportunities for women to really be promoted through the ranks?
I think so. I don't think that any young woman joins the military thinking that she's going to be held back or is not going to be able to reach her full potential. But by allowing women to join these combat arms branches, we should see more women rise to the very top of the military, which is your general officer, your flag ranks. 80% of the generals right now come from the combat arms branches, which up until now only men could serve in. So women are underrepresented at the very highest levels. They make up 14.5% of the military, but only 7% of the general officer ranks and only 11% of the highest levels of your non-commissioned officer rank.
Well, and with your unique perspective, how do you feel about the decision?
I think it's very good news. I was surprised by how quickly the change came. I knew that change was coming. It was really an affirmation of where the military has been headed. If you look at the last 10-plus years of how women have served and performed in Iraq and Afghanistan, 250,000 women have deployed since 9/11, and they've served side-by-side with men. If you talk to your battlefield commanders, they've been very impressed with the service women's performance.
But that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, women were already serving in combat zones before the ban was lifted, right? They just didn't really get the recognition.
Well, the difference is they were serving, but they were serving in support roles, for example, as intelligence officers, truck drivers, medics, signal officers, on and on. But those were in support roles. But what has happened since in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's no front lines. They found themselves in danger, and they found themselves in combat, IEDs, firefights. They found themselves in situations that the way the policy was written, it quickly became outdated, and it did not reflect the reality on the ground overseas. So that's why this change is taking place now.
And will women be treated any differently than men in combat, or will it be gender neutral?
What General Dempsey has said, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the Department of Defense is looking at gender-neutral standards, how much strength, how much endurance is needed to do a specific job. The specifics of that are going to be outlined in mid-May, so we're going to know more. But I don't think if you talk to anyone, no one wants the standards to be lowered for men or for women. And I believe that if a serviceman or servicewoman can meet the qualifications of a specific job, he or she should be able to serve in that position.
Do you think, though, Tanya, that's a way to weed out women? I mean, you put the standards so high that women, most women don't have the physical strength of men, that they just won't even be accepted into that particular branch?
I don't think that the Secretary of Defense and also General Dempsey wants that to happen. And I think there's going to be safeguards that that doesn't happen. But at the same time, no one wants the standards to be lowered. I don't know if the average woman will be able to serve in the infantry because of strength and endurance issues. But guess what? A select group of women will be able to meet those standards. And those women who want that kind of challenge and want to serve in the combat arms branches should be able to do so. I think it's very interesting that if you look at most young people who want to join the military, 75% do not qualify because they are not physically fit, or they're poorly educated, or they have criminal backgrounds. So really, one in four men is unfit for military service. So I think that lifting this ban, instead of a young man being automatically able to join the infantry because of his gender, he's also going to have to meet the standards now.
This is Kathy with the Two Boomer Babes. We're discussing the Pentagon's recent decision to allow women to serve on the front lines of combat. Much more to come with our guest, Tanya Bianc, the author of Undaunted. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up at 5.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes with Kathy and Barb. We're back with our guest, Tanya Bianc, author of Undaunted. She's the daughter of an Army colonel, the sister of one, and she's married to one. I'll say she's had exposure to the military. Tanya, let's talk about some unique issues female soldiers face. You've written that women who deploy encountered a real double standard, especially those that are mothers. What do you mean by that?
I think it's very difficult for service women who are married and also mothers, especially if you've got young children, like Major Candace O'Brien, one of the women who I write about in Undaunted. She deploys for the second time to Afghanistan, and she's got a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old. Her marriage is in trouble. And it was a double standard. People she would run into, sometimes it was friends, other times complete strangers who knew she was a mother and deploying, they would say to her, how can you do this? How can you leave behind your 2- and 4-year-old? And sometimes they said it out of pity. Sometimes it was said out of scorn. And to Major O'Brien, this was her duty. She had to go. Yes, it was heartbreaking for her to leave her family behind, but she had a duty. And in the military, the mission comes first. And everyone who joins the military understands that. And it's a double standard because I don't know as a society if we would say to a serviceman who was a father leaving his 2- and 4-year-old behind, I don't think we would say out of scorn to him, how could you do this? We would understand that he was making this sacrifice and this was his duty. And we would think, wow, what an honorable thing that he is doing. We do not afford that to many of our service women who are mothers.
And you mentioned about how hard it can be on a marriage, and I would imagine especially so when your spouse is also a soldier.
Very, very hard for dual military couples. And a dual military couple is when both the husband and wife are serving in uniform. My sister, who is in the Army, her husband is also in the Army as well. And so it's really tough. And then you add children into the mix, and it can be very, very difficult. And if you look at the divorce rate for service women, half of all service women are married to another service member. And the divorce rate is quite high. It's almost 8% for married service women. And when you compare that to service men, their divorce rate is only 3%, and the national divorce rate, the average is 3.5%. So it's pretty high for these women because they're facing a lot of challenges.
Well, and the alarming number of sexual harassment and rape cases of female soldiers, that's been all over the news before the ban was lifted. With more women who will now be serving on the front lines, do you think this will get worse for female soldiers?
I certainly hope not. I think that the two issues of lifting this ban and then also the problem of sexual assault in the military are two different issues. Sexual assault in the military is quite high. One recent study, 1,100 service women who had recently come back from a deployment, and a quarter of those women said that they had been sexually assaulted. Half of them said that they had been sexually harassed. The conviction rate for sexual assault and rape cases is dreadfully low in the military. It's just 6 to 8%. Leon Panetta has called that an outrage. And I do believe that the military is going to handle this issue appropriately. There's been a lot of media scrutiny, as you said, on this, and something has got to change.
I get that allowing women to serve in combat is a huge step towards equalizing opportunities for women in the military. But that said, do you think women will really be flooding into their local recruitment office now that the ban is lifted? Do women in significant numbers really want to be in combat?
I don't think it's going to change the recruitment levels for men or women, but I know of a number of women, if that had been an option for them, joining the infantry or the field artillery or the armor branches, they would have loved to have had that challenge. They would have loved to have done that, and I think our young women should have that opportunity.
Tanya Bianc, author of Undaunted, The Real Story of America's Servicewomen in Today's Military, thanks so much for sharing your perspective on women serving in combat.
Thank you, Kathy and Barb.
Up next, the sweet story of Milton Hershey and the chocolate that bears his name. We'll be right back after the break.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Chocolate. So many adjectives to describe this food of the gods. Sumptuous, dense, and seductive. To many, including the babes, chocolate is happiness, pleasure, love, even ecstasy. And speaking of ecstasy, some say they love chocolate, well, more than just about anything.
Barbara, let's not get carried away. But then what about that Hershey bar and those Hershey kisses, which we boomers grew up with? To this day, the name Hershey is synonymous with good old American chocolate. And behind this chocolate brand is a most unusual man, Milton Hershey. Joining us on the phone from Manhattan to talk about Hershey's fascinating legacy is Michael D'Antonio. He is the author of Hershey, Milton S. Hershey's Extraordinary Life of Wealth, Empire, and Utopian Dreams. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Oh, thank you very much.
In order to really understand how revolutionary Milton Hershey was, let's first talk about his upbringing. Now, he was raised by a Mennonite family, you know, and it's not exactly a religion associated with big business, so he really wasn't born into wealth, right?
On his father's side, definitely not. His mom's family had quite a bit of money. They were landowners and landlords all around Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But his dad was a very playful, very ambitious, but not very wily entrepreneur. So he had a lot of different schemes to try and make money, including a very fanciful farm where he thought he could grow hybrids that would attract actually agricultural tourists. And none of this worked, but I think Milton got the idea to be ambitious and the inspiration for his ambition, watching his dad try so hard.
So how did he get started in the candy business? We understand it wasn't even with chocolate, right?
No, and one thing that I think surprises a lot of folks is that chocolate that you could eat was a rarity up until around 1880. Prior to that, it was not well preserved in the summer months. Sometimes you could get it in cold weather in a big city, but it was a real delicacy and generally not very good. Prior to that, the big craze was caramels, and similar to the caramels we know now, hard and soft ones, but it would also be flavored with chocolate or vanilla. And that was Milton's first big break. He succeeded in Lancaster with a caramel company that he started as a one-man operation. And he literally walked the streets of that small city with a basket selling candies one by one until he got a very big contract from a businessman who actually shipped the product to London. That check of £500 was what got him off and running.
So how did he think about getting into the chocolate business? And I'm getting really hungry,
I
have to tell
you. My stomach is growling.
Well, you know, like so many advances of the 19th century, chocolate making was displayed at the Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1892. And he went and saw a chocolate factory in miniature working on the grounds of the fair and was transfixed by this, saw that it was a workable process, and when the fair closed, he bought the whole factory and had it shipped to his place in Pennsylvania.
What is it that sets Hershey apart from most of the other titans of the industry?
If you go to Hershey, and if you drive in, when you step out of your car, you smell chocolate in the air. At the end of Chocolate Avenue, near where it intersects with Cocoa Street, there's a big, tall, two actually, big, tall smokestacks that say Hershey on them. This was kind of the engine for the development of his little city, and it was a utopian concept. I compare it to Arab sheiks who would build a city out of the revenues from oil wells, but his supply of energy and revenue was the chocolate factory. The streets that stretch out from the factory premises are lined with very beautiful houses. At the time they were built, they were as technologically advanced as possible, which meant that they had central heating and electrical supplies and plumbing. And Milton was so concerned about the appearance of the place that he would drive up and down and monitor who had their grass cut properly and whose garden was well kept. And you were deviating from the norm, he let you know it. So it was kind of a worker's paradise, but it was ruled by one guy, and he definitely was a dictator.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the creator of the Hershey Kisses chocolate, Milton Hershey, with author Michael D'Antonio. His book is aptly titled Hershey. We were talking about these revolutionary concepts of indoor plumbing and even a trolley system. Didn't he introduce the idea of pensions and days off and unemployment and sick leave? All these things that we take for granted today that really were revolutionary in those times?
Yes, he was a very benevolent employer. I think that it was good business. He saw that if he could develop a worker and keep him or her over a long period of time, they became more reliable and more efficient. And these benefits also included all the facilities in the town. This was during the age of something called the City Beautiful movement. And there was an idealized vision of community that was popular in America and in Europe, too. Everyone joined a club and everyone played on a team. And you made good use of the facilities that were offered by your community. And he pioneered a lot of that. You know, one of the more fun things that he did was open this zoo that was supposed to be both a draw for tourists and also a pleasure for the community. And every once in a while, the monkeys would get out and be found in the elm and pine trees of Pennsylvania. Eventually, they'd be corralled. And it was just something that made it a special place to live and a great place to work.
And he also really believed in the pride of home ownership, correct?
Yes, but this is sort of a double-edged thing. And I think as much as we can idealize Milton, it's important to know that workers did sometimes chafe at the top-to-bottom control that he had. If you bought a house there, chances are you financed it with the company. And so your job was dependent on Mr. Hershey, but so was your mortgage. And if you rented, you may be renting from him as well. So it's a complex thing, and like most visions of utopia, it had enough flaws in it that it couldn't last.
That brings us to the question. I mean, he sounds like a great guy, but, you know, nobody's perfect here. As you say, some of the workers viewed him as this, and I quote, an egotistical captain of industry. And you give an example of a junior officer worker who actually made the mistake of asking Mr. Hershey for some water. Can you tell us that story?
As I recall, he lost his job because this was just not proper etiquette. You know, there's a great lesson in Japanese business culture where if you enter a meeting, you know that the person seated furthest from the door is the most powerful person. And that's just manners in Japanese business. And in Hershey's time, you didn't ask the boss to serve you, you served the boss. And I suspect that's the case today, too. So he could be tough if he encountered someone playing a practical joke on company grounds. He could fire you, and he did fire people for little offenses like that. What happened over time is during the Great Depression, he maintained employment fairly well and bucked the trend of cutting the ranks of employees, but eventually enough resentment built up that he had a little rebellion on his hands, and near the end of his life, that conflict was probably the most significant development in the town.
Well, how is his legacy perceived today?
Now, I think people know him for the product, which was revolutionary in many, many ways. The consistency that he achieved, the low cost. You know, when you think of how little a chocolate bar still costs these days compared with the rate of inflation, it's pretty remarkable. You can get this treat almost anywhere for a buck or so, and it's the same wherever you get it. But his other legacy is the Milton Hershey School. People who have visited are very impressed by how beautiful the facility is, the offerings that it makes for students, and by the fact that these kids who attend, and it's a boarding school, are drawn from the neediest families in the country, and they often are the kids who have the toughest road ahead of them. The Hershey School will solicit nominations for placement in the school from guidance counselors and superintendents and principals, and these kids get a prep school-like education, and if they succeed and graduate, they get a four-year scholarship to any college they can get admitted to.
Well, Michael, are there any present-day moguls that you can think of that have similar values to Milton Hershey that really want to leave a legacy?
Well, you know, Warren Buffett comes immediately to mind, and so does Bill Gates. And they both are very busy giving away their fortunes. And I think they both have the idea that what they've amassed is there for a greater good than just themselves and their families. And Milton believed in the same thing. Ironically, he didn't have a family. He and his wife could not have children. So he considered the boys and then later girls of the Hershey School to be his heirs. It's now the single biggest trust outside of major universities of any educational system in the world. So they have so much money, and their resources are so great that they should be able to maintain their activities for many generations to come.
Well, Michael D'Antonio, author of Hershey, Milton S. Hershey's Extraordinary Life of Wealth, Empire, and Utopian Dreams, thanks so much for sharing this incredible story with the two Boomer Babes.
Well, I really appreciate it. You know, next best thing to eating chocolate, I guess, is talking about it.
And we're going to eat some very soon, Michael.
Absolutely.
Up next, itching to get out on the open road? We'll shoot the breeze about buying an RV. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate. Mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
We babes love to travel. We'll go just about anywhere if it involves an adventure. So we thought, why not hit the road in style in an RV?
Yes, a recreational vehicle. I think I'm all for it.
But since RVs have never obviously been on our radar screen, we thought it would be great fun to explore the options.
So we contacted journalist Melanie Kaplan. She wrote a terrific article for the Washington Post about the adventures of shopping for RVs. Her research turned up some amazing possibilities. Melanie joins us on the phone from somewhere on the road to shoot the breeze with the babes. Welcome, Melanie, to the show.
We were really surprised to learn how popular RVs are as a mode of vacation travel. You know, we're not talking pop-up campers, right?
The RVs out there today are pretty luxurious. I think the most expensive one that I have seen is about $362,000, and it's a Winnebago model. It's pretty much everything you need inside.
Wow.
I hope so for that amount.
My gosh.
That doesn't include land.
You could buy a nice house for that.
Absolutely. Just the front part where you drive, you've got touch screens and cameras and CD players with remotes, because everything's so big, you're so far away, you probably can't even touch the CD player. And you've got tile floors and hardwood and stainless steel appliances and the whole nine yards.
So do RVs have separate bedrooms, I hope, for $365,000, or just those pop-up couches that open up?
Usually have a master suite in the back and a bathroom back there. And then in the front area, a lot of the couches will turn into sleeping areas, so you could sleep as many as seven or more people in there.
We could have lots of company on the way. You know, I want a Tempur-Pedic or a Sleep Number mattress.
There's one of these where they've got, you can digitally control the mattress. There's like 50 different settings. So you can have each side be a different level of firmness. Nothing was missed.
And what about washers and dryers? Not that I want to do laundry on vacation, but do they have them?
I think that's an option for some of them.
Well, most importantly, we want to know if they have wine coolers.
I'm sure you could include those too. I didn't see any of those specifically when I was looking, but there's so many options.
Well, that's a very important option for boomers. I mean, they should be doing their market research.
Okay, well, what about screen porches? I keep thinking this $365,000 because we really hate bugs, Melanie.
I hate bugs too. Some of these do have separate areas in the back where when you're driving, you can actually tow with some of your toys, like your bike or your kayak, and then once you're all unpacked, you take the gear out, and it's just, you can sit out there, and it's your back patio, and it's screened in. It's really nice.
How popular are these? I mean, do they really sell a lot? I can't imagine for $365,000, they're just, you know, flying off the showroom.
You know, I don't know how many of those are, but there's so many different levels. You can also just get some tow trailers for as little as $5,000. According to the Recreational Vehicles Industry Association, there were about 250,000 sold in 2011. The numbers just keep increasing. I think they're forecasting a little over 300,000 sales this year in the United States.
Can we rent one if we just sort of want to try it out and see if we like it? And if so, how much does that cost?
You can. I just did a quick little search, and if I picked up a standard medium-sized RV in Richmond, Virginia for a month, the cost of that is about $5,000.
Wow.
So it's not cheap, but I do know that it's similar to a car, maybe even more so, where as soon as you drive it off the lot, it depreciates significantly. So I think you could probably buy a used one for a pretty good deal.
I can't even imagine being able to afford to gas them up. It would cost a fortune, way more than what we babes make.
That's right. We need a raise.
Yeah, if you have to ask, you can't afford it. But yeah. I think they average from like 8 to 20 miles a gallon. And you better believe the biggest ones are closer to 8.
Well, Post writer Melanie Kaplan, thanks so much for giving us a skinny on the latest and greatest RVs. We babes are going to hit the road in style.
Have fun.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Going to consignment shops can be hit or really miss. You're sorting through racks upon racks of dusty clothes, and the odds of scoring that designer label find, in your size no less, is akin to winning the lottery 5 times in a row.
For all you consignment-loving listeners, your luck is about to change. There's a new website called RealReal.com, which offers gently used designer duds at bargain basement prices. Joining us to shoot the breeze is Ann Paolini, Executive Vice President of Sales at RealReal.com. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Thank you. It's great to be part of the show.
Well, briefly, tell us how RealReal works.
So the RealReal is a full-service online luxury resale marketplace. And that's a mouthful, but it really does describe exactly what we are.
Now, are we just talking about designer clothing? Are we talking about jewelry and purses or anything else?
No, it's a full product selection. The RealReal sells apparel, handbags, shoes, accessories, fine jewelry, watches for both men and women. Let's not forget the men. And very recently, we've just expanded the categories to include art, based on our consigner's request.
Well, now, how much of a discount can a customer expect? Give us an example.
So a customer, somebody shopping on the site, can find values from 70% off of original retail for most products on the site. Some products that are more highly desirable or are very close to brand new will be more expensive than that or less discounted than that. But it is great bargains for everybody across all categories of product.
And if we actually purchase the merchandise and we receive it but it doesn't fit, can it be returned?
It absolutely can be returned with some few exceptions. So we take returns on ready-to-wear and shoes, and that covers a lot of the categories that are represented on the site. We want it to fit properly. We want our consumers to be happy with the product. So taking returns is certainly part of the service we offer.
So, Anne, give us an example from your site of a really great deal that will really make our boomer hearts go pitter-patter.
Well, I think there's a deal for everybody. It depends on what you're looking for. So let's say you had your heart set on a dress that you didn't buy two or three seasons ago, but you find it on the site, and it's exactly the one you remembered loving. And now it's going to be on the site for, say, $125, and it could have been two or three times that price in the stores a couple of seasons ago. So dresses at $125, skirts at similar price points, $75 to $100, jackets, $200. Now, if they're premier luxury vendors, let's say Chanel, for example, they would certainly be more expensive than that. And if it's a very recent season product, it could be, say, $400, but still well off the original retail prices of that product. And in many cases, the product that we sell from our consigners still has tags on it, and that's always clearly described on the site.
Well, who are some of your consigners?
Our consigners come from all over the country, and they're people who I think, like you, certainly like me, have gotten to a certain stage in life where their closets are full, and they're looking for an opportunity to free up some space so that they can keep shopping, or maybe free up some space so that they can take some of their earnings and apply it to a trip instead. So priorities have changed, or priorities haven't changed. They want to continue to shop. They just need a little bit more space in their closet.
So, Anne, so say a customer goes on the site, and I see a stunning designer dress at really at a rock-bottom price. How do I know it's the real thing? Do you have people that actually authenticate the products?
We do, and that is a big feature. I think that provides the confidence for both our consigners and our consumers that the authentication process is quite detailed. We've got a specialist who has a team who really have a lot of detail and understanding, not only ready-to-wear, but accessories, handbags, and jewelry. We have a gemologist on board, and we also have a watch specialist on board because clearly, it is so important to both the consigner and the consumer that what is represented is, in fact, 100% authentic.
Anne Paolini, Executive Vice President of Sales at RealReal.com. You have one cool job, and we are drooling. Thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the two boomer babes.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.
Support.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.